want to welcome you all to our second case for this September to June 2009-2010 term. We especially want to welcome Xavier High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And West Salem High School students, would they stand, please? You are welcome to come too, and thank you for coming. You may be seated. Now that we've met our special guests, the students, let me tell you that these students are here today under the auspices of the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We have a program that's been in existence for a number of years now. Thousands of students have attended the court proceeding. Each year we invite students from all over the state to come to the court. If the invitation is accepted, we will then send the students materials about the case. They may do some outside activities about the case, such as invite counsel to talk about the case, and then come for an oral argument. And then after this oral argument, the students will meet with the justice of this court to discuss the procedures that the court follows in hearing cases and deciding cases. They do not discuss the substantive issues of the case in which they've participated by being here. Everyone is invited to attend the proceeding after this hearing ends. You're all invited to stay and talk with the justice and the students. Now, the students have materials on the case. If other people in the courtroom would like a summary of the facts and legal issue in the case, you raise your hand. The marshal will give you that summary. It's hard to understand an oral argument if you know nothing about what's happening. It's much easier if you have some concept of the facts and the question of law. This was prepared by our public information officer, Mr. Sheehan. Anyone else want this summary? All right. Let me introduce the court to you now that we've met some of our special guests. But we have another special guest. Is Attorney Kate Finley in the courtroom? Ms. Finley, if you'd stand, and you are attending this with a visiting scholar from Germany, I believe, Eliane Werner. And we're delighted to have you with us. And you are an academic or in Germany and the city or school? And what's your subject, did you say? Criminal law. Well, that makes sense that why you are here. Right. Well, you are quite welcome. And if we end before 12:15, I would be delighted to meet with you, but at 12:15, I have another kind of hearing, but perhaps we can make arrangements for other meetings, Ms. Finley, okay? Good. So now we'll make introductions of the court. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And the justice who will meet with you all after this proceeding ends is Justice Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With the introductions made, I have one other comment I wish to make, and then we'll proceed with the case. Today is, as you all know, September 11th, and 8 years ago, this country and the world faced an attack which thousands thousands have died and in memory of September 11th, maybe take a few moments of silence. Call our second case, 08AP880CR, State versus Robert L. Artic, Sr. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Artic is Attorney Keith A. Finley of the Remington Center in the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Mr. Finley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Just this last term in Arizona versus Gantt, the United States Supreme Court reminded us, as it has on many occasions, that our analysis begins with the basic rule that searches conducted outside the judicial process without prior approval by judge or magistrate are per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, subject only to a few specifically and well-delineated exceptions. In this case, police, acting without a warrant, entered the curtilage of Robert Artic's home, then pounded on Mr. Artic's front door while hollering Milwaukee police repeatedly and very loudly, and then broke down his two front doors and swept through his home with weapons drawn. There is no dispute on these facts that police acted illegally when they forced their way into the home and swarmed through the house with their guns drawn without a warrant. The issues before this court are first, whether Mr. Artic's consent, obtained after police broke down his front doors and entered his home with guns drawn, was granted voluntarily. And second, even if the consent was voluntary, whether it was sufficiently attenuated from the illegal entry to purge that primary taint. A no answer to either of those separate questions requires reversal of the Court of Appeals decision and suppression of the evidence. And on these facts, indeed, the answer to both questions is no. First, any consent obtained was not voluntary. And second, even if it was voluntary, it was not sufficiently attenuated from the illegal entry to purge that primary taint.
Did the trial court make a decision on voluntariness? I know it made a decision that there was consent.
The trial court did make a finding that Mr. Artic consented, and I'm sorry, I'm not recalling whether the court specifically addressed the voluntariness question or not. It was implicit in the court's finding.
I'm pointed out by Justice Bradley that they did, but it's a trick question because we're not bound by the
fact. We're not.
It's not a finding of fact.
In fact, Justice Abrahamson, your question raises the next point I want to make, which is that on the consent question, there are, in fact, two sub-issues. And the first is, as a matter of historical fact, did he consent? And the second question is, which is a separate question, if he did consent, was it voluntary? That first question is a question of historical fact, to which this court defers unless the trial court's finding was clearly erroneous. While Mr. Artic maintains that he did not consent, we recognize that there was evidence supporting the trial court's determination. The finding was not clearly erroneous, and therefore, the fact of consent is not an issue before this court today. We are not challenging that.
Because he said, come on in.
According to the police officers, he said, come on in, and explicitly granted permission to search. He says he denied permission, but that is not a matter that we're concerned about today.
But said he was incredible.
That's right. So that's why we're not challenging that finding. But we are challenging the question of law that's presented here. And that's the question about whether that consent was voluntarily granted.
Mr. Finley, let me follow through with what the Chief Justice asked you. She asked you about whether or not the circuit court made a determination and addressed the issue of voluntariness of the consent. Did the Court of Appeals do that?
Yes, the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals accepted the fact that the entry was illegal, but made a finding that the consent was voluntary and sufficiently attenuated. Our position here today is that the Court of Appeals erred in both respects.
why do you feel that the consent here was not voluntary? My understanding of the facts is that there's a period of time after the officers enter the apartment, call it what you will, on the second floor, where the officers wait while the female companion of the defendant gets dressed. They then go in and they sit at the kitchen table, and they chit-chat at least for a short period of time, and then there apparently is consent to search. Now, isn't that important both on the issue of voluntariness and on the issue of attenuation?
Those facts are certainly relevant on both issues, but I don't think that they show either voluntariness or attenuation for these reasons. Keep in mind that voluntariness requires consent to be the product of an essentially free and unconstrained choice. Consent is invalid if it is really just reflects acquiescence to an unlawful assertion of authority. Your question suggests that perhaps the incident began when the police knocked on the upstairs doorway.
I know there were things that went on before.
Right. I think we have to put this thing in context. First off, understand this was Mr. Artick's home. The whole thing was his home. It was a single-family dwelling. He happened to have his bedroom upstairs. There was a kitchen upstairs. There was no kitchen on the first floor. There was a shell of a kitchen, but it had been completely removed. No appliances, no plumbing. This was one home, and it began, the encounter began when police pounded on the front door, demanded entry by hollering repeatedly, Milwaukee police. This was no encounter where a neighbor came by and politely rang the doorbell to see if you're home. This was six or seven or more police officers surrounding the house, pounding violently on the door, hollering increasingly loudly, so loud that one officer said they could be heard down the block, demanding entry. When they didn't enter, the officer kicked in not one, but two front doors. They swarmed through the house with guns drawn, went upstairs, and then found another door, an internal door, pounded on that door, repeated the same behavior they'd conducted down outside, that is, knocking on the door and announcing Milwaukee police. At that point, he opened the door, let them in, and they claimed that he consented. Now, keep in mind, the time span here was very short. Police officers testified that they moved quickly through the house, that they went upstairs, that Mr. Artick opened the door after a very brief period, that they then said, bring your girlfriend out, and he said, she's not dressed. They said, tell her to get dressed. She got dressed and came out, but they said that was very shortly thereafter. And then they said their entire conversation with Mr. Artick took less than 5 minutes and that the consent was obtained within the first few minutes. Imagine, if you will, if police pounded on your door in your home while you're upstairs in at night, 3.5 hours after dark, up in your bedroom. They pound on your door loudly. They holler, Milwaukee police. You choose, as is your right, not to answer the door. But they then break open the door, come through the house with weapons drawn, come to your bedroom, find the door closed, knock on it again, enter. How many of us here would really feel that they have a choice at that point as to whether or not to let the police conduct a search? Police had already demonstrated that they would not take no for an answer, that if need be, they would break down doorways, pull out guns, do whatever it took. This was not a free choice. This was mere acquiescence to what had been a very, very overwhelming show of police authority.
Well, there's a dispute as to whether the guns were drawn or that they were put away before there was an entry.
There is no dispute that multiple officers had their guns drawn as they went through the downstairs. The record's really hard to figure that out, but there were, I count at least seven officers involved in this incident. It's not clear who went in when, but there were multiple officers who went in the home. We know from at least Detectives Lopez and Wagner, both of them said they had their guns out. The only dispute about weapons is when Detective Wagner put his gun away. He acknowledges that he had it out when Mr. Artick opened the upstairs doorway. Detective Wagner thinks he might have put it away at that point, but is pretty sure he put it away at least by the time they were sitting at the kitchen table. There is no dispute that this is a situation where Mr. Artick was aware that police were in his home with weapons drawn.
Now, the state, as I understand it, agrees that the initial entry was not legal. Is that right?
I'm sorry, the state?
Does the state agree that yes. the initial initial entry was not legal.
The state has conceded that the initial entry was not legal, and the Court of Appeals has accepted that concession, as is entirely appropriate here, given that there were multiple illegalities.
Did they make that argument about legality at the trial court? Was that the state's position at the trial court, that this was an illegal entry?
No, the state's position in the trial court was that the police entered lawfully with exigent circumstances.
Okay.
And that was the finding of the circuit court. On appeal, the state abandoned...
They haven't forfeited that argument.
On appeal, they did.
Well, on appeal. Okay.
Yes.
Why wasn't it exigent circumstances?
Well, there are at least two reasons. One, well, there are multiple reasons, really. One, just given the facts that the police had at their disposal, I don't think there were some exigent circumstances. All they knew was that when they pounded on the door, they heard somebody moving in the house, saw a light go off, and heard a telephone ring.
Normal. The claim of exigent circumstances. So
the claim is that the inhabitants of the home would destroy evidence or arm themselves.
All right.
Okay? There was no indication that people inside were flushing toilets to get rid of drugs, that they were saying it's the cops, whatever it may be. They were just moving about the house as was their right. But even if we accept that somehow that created exigent circumstances, that doesn't justify the entry here, because the police only obtained that information by invading the curtilage of the home. It was only the officer within the fenced-in backyard by the back door who heard those footsteps on the stairways and saw the light going off and heard the phone ring. So the police had no right to even have that information. And beyond that, the final reason is...
Could I follow up on that? This incident followed an arrest of another individual.
That's right.
Isn't that right? This incident... really came about when the police wanted to secure the house while they obtained the search warrant. Is that fair?
That's what they testified to.
All right. So it wouldn't have been improper to knock on the door of the front house.
It's certainly
the door of the house.
They had every right to knock on the door, just as anyone did. But what they did was they gambled that by knocking on the door, Mr. Hardick would let them in.
Okay.
If he chose not to let them in, they had to accept that. And that gets to the other point about exigent circumstances. Is here, this can't be exigent circumstances because this is a situation where if there were exigent circumstances, they were circumstances created by the police themselves when they chose to take that gamble to knock on that door. And multiple courts around the country have recognized that police may not manufacture their own exigent circumstances by knocking on the door when they have an alternative. And in this case, they had an alternative, which was to stake out the house, which was in fact their original plan, to remain quietly in the neighborhood, get a warrant, and then come back with the warrant. There was no indication. They did everything they could to make sure that they could stake out the home quietly. There was no indication that they had to go storm the house at that moment when they had not given the inhabitants, the people within the home, any indication they were even there. In fact, they didn't even know if anybody was home at the time.
Well, the question would be, is this a two-story house?
This is a two-story house, yes.
Are there windows in the front of the house?
There are windows in the front of the house.
Was there an arrest made in front of the house?
It was several doors down on the same block with officers in plain clothes and unmarked cars who whisked the arrested person away very quickly, precisely for the reason that they wanted to make sure that no one saw them. That's what they did, and there's no evidence in the record whatsoever that anything changed after they devised that plan and whisked him away so that they could stake out the evidence.
But was there a back door to the house?
There was a back door at the house. And that's where the one officer had invaded the curtilage to go position herself by the back door.
So it was unreasonable to have someone near the back door. Is that right?
It was unreasonable in the sense that it was a violation of the curtilage. That itself was a Fourth Amendment violation. If they were trying to surround the home and they weren't obtaining any evidence, perhaps no one would have known or cared about that. The problem is that the police are now trying to use that illegal behavior to allow them to get inside the house and then obtain other evidence.
Where should they have been if they wanted to prevent someone from fleeing out the back door, where should they have been?
They could have been outside the back fenced area on the back side of that. They were, could have been positioned throughout the block. The simple fact of the matter is, keep in mind, it is not the defendant's burden to prove the reasonableness here. And the simple fact is that the police officer's own testimony was that they intended to do that and could do that. They just, for some reason, chose not to.
But to kind of prevent someone from fleeing from the back door of the house, wouldn't they have had to be on somebody else's curtilage?
They might have been, or they might have been across the block. Again, the record doesn't tell us those things, and it's not the defendant's burden to prove the reasonableness of the warrantless entry. So if the record doesn't tell us that, that's not the defendant's fault. But even if they had no chance, if they had no choice but to invade someone's curtilage to secure the home, they could have made that calculated cost decision and invaded the curtilage with the knowledge that whatever evidence they obtained as a result of that invasion, they couldn't use. They could still do it, and it would still be preferable to do that and get a warrant and then enter with the warrant than it would be to try to invade the curtilage and then use the evidence obtained in that manner as a way to piggyback into getting evidence that they found inside the home. That they clearly cannot do. So,
Robert Lee Artick is the defendant appellant petitioner. You represent him. Who is the person that was arrested by the...
His son. An adult son.
Adult son. And that they saw the adult son apparently go into your client's home?
They did.
And then after your client's son left your client's home, he was picked up for drugs, right? Did he get into his car?
He did get into his car, and he was arrested within seconds after getting into his car, and they found cocaine.
They found cocaine, and so the inference is that he got the cocaine at the house of your client, whether it was his or his father's, that's where he got it. And that's how it wound up on the car.
That's right.
So that would indicate that there, maybe you don't think so, the inference can reasonably be made that there's cocaine in that house, right?
Probable cause is not an issue in this case. We're not challenging probable cause.
Okay, I understand that. But that might have been enough for a search warrant for that house.
That's correct.
Right.
Police made that judgment, and that's why they initially planned to go get a search warrant.
Right. If your position is without a warrant, they can't do this.
Without a warrant, they can't do this. They could, of course, go knock on the door, and if Mr. Artick voluntarily lets them in, no problem.
The problem with that, in this case, is you're saying they were legally when they're knocking at the door.
Well, they were legally knocking on the door. They were illegally stationed at the back door, and they illegally broke down the door based on the information obtained illegally from the back door. And when they had any exigent circumstances, they manufactured themselves.
Well, the Fourth Amendment is a reasonableness test.
Yes.
How can it be reasonable that you're going to let these people in this house, which appears to be a drug house, you're going to let them in the house, and you're going to dawdle around and get a search warrant, and they can flush everything down the toilet. They can put it in containers with appropriate fluids that would destroy it. And you, in the meantime, are getting a search warrant. Why isn't it exigent circumstance?
Why isn't it exigent circumstances? It's not because the mere possibility that someone within the home might be destroying evidence isn't good enough. There has to be some indication, some evidence that that's what's happening. And it's not good enough on these facts. And as many courts have recognized, it's not good enough on facts like these when police have an alternative, which is to stake out the home surreptitiously.
If the court takes your position, then even though there's probable cause to believe there's drugs in the house and that it's a seller, not just a user, even if the court takes that position and says you don't have to have a warrant, it's exigent circumstance, of course drugs can be destroyed, if it takes your position that's not good enough, then maybe the court is giving a free license to all these drug houses.
No, I don't think so.
Escape detection.
No, I don't think so, because the police can search. They just need to get a warrant. And they can. And
what will it take to get a warrant?
The record doesn't show that, but we don't know. There are telephonic.
Well, I'm just, so it's Milwaukee, right?
It's Milwaukee. It's a busy jurisdiction. They are well staffed and can handle this kind of thing on short notice.
Sure. Well, you can also reach the other position that they're busy, they're well staffed. It's at night.
It's not a one judge county where the judge may be, you know. That's all I'm trying to say.
It's a duty judge or judges.
Yeah. I believe that's right. The point is that without even trying, they can't force without even trying to get a warrant, police can't reasonably force their way into the home. Now, I'm not saying give the criminal elements a free pass. What I'm saying is it's not reasonable to barge into somebody's home when there's no reason to believe that they know you're there, and there's no reason to believe that they are, in fact, in the process of destroying the evidence. In fact, in the case of United States versus Ellis, the Seventh Circuit addressed very similar circumstances where the defendant inside, the police officer by the back door heard somebody running up and down the stairs. The Seventh Circuit ruled that does not create exigent circumstances. It doesn't, because that's normal activity within the home. There was nobody yelling, "It's the cops." There was nobody flushing things down the toilet. And they said, if we give the police a pass on this, then the warrant requirement's gone. Because anytime police want to enter a home for a drug search, all they have to do is knock on the door. And whatever response they get to come in. Why? Because there's really only three things that a person, a homeowner, a dweller, could do under those circumstances. First, the person can answer the door. Doesn't have to, but the person is, absolutely not required to answer the door. But the person could answer the door. And the person can consent and let them in, and all is well and good. The person, however, might answer the door and then say, no, you can't come in. In which case, the police would, as they did in this case, claim, well, now they know we're here, they're going to destroy drugs, now we've got exigent circumstances, now we must search, we're going to force our way in. Second thing the homeowner could do is do what Mr. Artic did in this case, was just ignore them and move about the home freely, as is his right to do. But as we see in this case, then the police claim, well, he's moving about the house, he knows we're here, they may be destroying evidence, we therefore can force our way in. The only other alternative that could avoid this scenario is that Mr. Artic could have hidden out in the dark in his own home, silently, as if surrounded by an intruding force, so that the police couldn't claim that they heard anything whatsoever. The Fourth Amendment does not permit that kind of an unreasonable burden to be placed on citizens within the privacy of their own homes. That is why this consent, this search cannot be justified by exigent circumstances or as voluntary or pursuant to the attenuation doctrine. And let me just say a few words specifically about attenuation. Before I do that, let me also point out that the case law is replete with examples, including those collected by Professor Lefebvre, indicating that when police enter with weapons drawn, it's almost unheard of for courts to find that the consent obtained thereafter is voluntary for obvious reasons. Turning to attenuation, keep in mind that keep in mind that attenuation is a separate question from voluntariness. Even if the consent, the entry was voluntary, it still must be suppressed unless it's sufficiently attenuated. And there are three factors we look at. One, the temporal proximity between the illegal conduct and the subsequent consent. Two, the intervening circumstances. And three, the purpose and flagrancy of the illegal conduct. The state, again, has the burden of showing attenuation. And I believe that on all three of these factors, the weight goes against the state. In terms of temporal span, the evidence in the record is this happened within 5 minutes or less. This was one episode. Police didn't ask for consent until they were already in the middle of their forced entry and search of Mr. Artic's home. This was instantaneously. And keep in mind that the Supreme Court on other occasions has held that much longer periods of time are not sufficient by themselves. In Brown versus Illinois, 2 hours, not enough to attenuate. In Dunaway versus New York, 1.5 hours, not enough to attenuate. In Taylor versus Alabama, 6 hours, not enough to attenuate. This court has recognized that entries of a matter of minutes are not enough to count as a sufficient temporal distance. The court has also recognized that temporal proximity is not the only factor and that a short duration can be overcome, but only under circumstances that are overwhelmingly congenial and friendly, situations where, as this court put it in Phillips, State versus Phillips, where police did not enter by breaking down doors, breaking through windows, or even opening a doorway. That's an entirely different circumstance than here. This is a very factor weighs heavily against attenuation. Intervening circumstances. The only conceivable intervening circumstances in this case are those that Justice Crooks has identified, that the police knocked on the upstairs doorway. Mr. Artick answered. They chatted with him for a few brief moments. But the request for consent to search cannot itself be an intervening factor because it is a part of the res gestae of obtaining the consent. It is part of that entire episode itself. And I see that my time is out. So I will all conclude here and resume the rebuttal.
You have 5 minutes in the rebuttal. Thomas J. Ballastieri, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. We have a lot of factual disputes in this case. I think it's fair to say that Mr. Artick and the state disagree on just about everything that's critical in terms of the facts in this case. The most important and fundamental disagreement between the parties in this case deals with the nature of the premises that were involved in this case. Mr. Artick, on this appeal, maintains that this was a single-family home and that he occupied the entire premises as his residence. That assertion is flatly contradicted by a number of statements in the record. And because it is so important, I would like to point out those statements in the record that flatly contradict the assertion that this was a single family.
Why don't you do that? Before you do that, tell us why that's important, please.
It is important because there was not one entry in this case. There were two entries, two very separate entries, which were made under very distinct and different circumstances. The first entry was to the outer door of the building, and no one has ever disputed that the police forced open that door. One of the officers kicked in the door. They didn't have a key. It wasn't open. It wasn't unlocked. One of the officers kicked it in. There's no question
about it. The outer door?
I'm sorry?
This is the outer door?
The outer door of the building.
Okay.
The second door was the door.
Why did they kick it in?
Because no one answered and because they thought they had exigent circumstances. They thought that cocaine was being destroyed. As it turns out, they were absolutely right. Cocaine was being destroyed.
If no one was there, how could it be destroyed?
I'm sorry?
If they thought no one was there, how could it be destroyed?
Well, they didn't think no one was there. That's not entirely correct. No one answered the door. But we have this police officer who was stationed in the yard who observed these furtive movements on the second floor of the house, conveyed that to the officers who were in the front, and once that was conveyed, that's when they kicked in the door. The entry to Mr. Artick's apartment was made very differently. This was, they didn't break in. They didn't force the door. They didn't kick it in. They simply knocked on the door, said who it was, and Mr. Artick knew by that time who it was because he had this camera out on his front porch. He could see what was going on. So he knew.
Well, you said they knocked on the door.
Yeah.
Now, your opposing counsel says pounded on the door. So, and you describe in your brief that this was congenial.
Yep. What happened after that was certainly.
Yeah. So it was a hello, hello, Milwaukee police here. I mean, what was it like? What were they doing? Was that how it was?
You know.
Good afternoon. Pizza delivery. So they knocked on the door, and they pounded on the door. And you're saying the facts are really important. So what is it? Is it this congenial?
You know,
is the gun strong?
We don't have any evidence in the record that specifically describes how they pounded on the door. But if you look at the entire record regarding what happened upstairs, it was a very congenial encounter. The police waited. They didn't pound and, well, this we know. This we know for sure. They didn't keep pounding and say, let us in, let us in. This is the police, and if you don't let us in, we're going to knock down the door. They knocked on the door, and they waited for Artic to answer the door. That we do know. That we do know. And when he answered, they did politely ask for permission to come in. They didn't just...
They had the guns up then or not when they were at the threshold of the door?
We know that they had their guns drawn. That is admitted. Exactly where the guns were pointed, that we really don't know.
So they were politely asking with politely drawn guns, right?
They were politely asking with politely drawn guns.
Counsel, if I could interrupt, I just want to make sure I have the sequence correct. Initially, they're outside in the front of the house. There's an officer in the back of the house, and they are loudly pounding on that door and 10 times announce that it's law enforcement.
Yeah.
They're wearing jackets that have badges on them that say police on the back, and there's a video camera that's pointed right at them.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, so that's the initial part. So 10 times they're pounding on that door, announcing police and knocking, right?
That's absolutely correct.
To the extent where the officer in the backyard can hear the officers in the front, right?
There's no question that they were loud.
Yet
very
the
loud.
Person in the home at trial, at the court hearing, the judge said, I don't find that person's testimony credible. When they're saying they didn't ever hear the law enforcement officers knocking on the door, right? That's what the trial court judge said regarding Mr. Artic's testimony that he didn't hear them knocking on the front door.
I believe that the trial court found that he was aware that the police were knocking on the outside door.
And found that Mr. Artic, the person on the second floor that we're talking about here today, not his son who was
right.
arrested, leaving the residence with the cocaine,
right.
but the person on the second floor who was arrested for cocaine in his apartment, that's the person we're talking about here today, right?
Yep.
So after they come in downstairs, after knocking loudly and repeatedly saying they're police and wearing the jackets that say they're police, then they go upstairs and they again knock on the door. They don't just barge through.
That
right?
is correct.
So I just want to clarify, the conversation you're having with Justice Bradley, is that regarding the second floor knocking on
yes,
the door?
Yes, we were talking about the second floor.
Okay, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I wanted to focus also on... You start with the facts, you know. There's that old adage, if you don't have the law, you start with the facts. I'm not sure that that's appropriate here, but I'd like to focus a little bit on the law. And you've also started with disagreements that you have with your opposing counsel. But I think on the law, you have several agreements.
Well, I think we agree. I think we basically agree on the law. It's the application of that law to the facts of this case in which we have this.
Well, I don't mean the law in the abstract. I mean, you agree that the entry was illegal.
Yes, we do.
And you agree that...
Let me, which
entry?
Excuse me, let me interrupt and just clarify that. We agree that the entry to the building was illegal through the outside door.
Yes, thank you.
We do not agree that the entry to the upstairs apartment was illegal.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Just want to make
thank
that clear.
You for that, because it's precisely correct. And you agree that the circuit court was wrong in finding, as a matter of law, in finding exigent circumstances.
We have to put this case in perspective. In the legal perspective, although neither of us have actually argued it from this perspective in this court, because we focused on the merits of the issues. This is an ineffective assistance of counsel case. In the Court of Appeals, the contention was that Artic's trial attorney was ineffective because he did not argue, among other things, that the fact that one of the police officers was unlawfully stationed in the curtilage when she observed the exigent circumstances affected the whole legality of the entry to the front door. And so we have to remember that that's the context of the appeal in this case, and that this appeal differs from the proceedings in the circuit court because that it was never contended in the circuit court that the state could not use exigent circumstances because the exigent circumstances were discovered unlawfully.
But that is the law. Yeah, you have it on page 9 of your brief, and her unlawful observations could not be used to justify an entry into the building on exigent circumstances, since that would be a direct exploitation of the initial illegality.
The illegality in being on the curtilage without appropriate reason for being there.
I want to get to the law of voluntariness also. Justice Crooks asked your opposing counsel regarding the Court of Appeals voluntariness analysis. When I read the Court of Appeals opinion, I didn't see any voluntariness analysis. And indeed, the last paragraph of their opinion indicates a review by a standard that's not clearly erroneous. In other words, the historical fact of consent, not the constitutional fact of consent, which would require a de novo review. Was the Court of Appeals in error in this case in failing to undertake a voluntariness analysis?
Well, I think they did, but they didn't.
Careful, because I'm going to ask you where they did it.
Yeah.
If you look at their analysis on the historical consent in paragraphs 20, 21, and 22,
yeah,
then they go right to attenuation.
Yeah.
And I didn't see any voluntary analysis. So if you did,
I can't point you to a specific statement in their opinion that is as specific as what you're going to find in my brief.
Yeah, in fact, your brief, I was going to say it was great. I don't mean that to suggest that I agree or disagree, but you really thoroughly analyzed it, whether you're right or wrong. Well, I guess we'll decide later, but you spent a large part of your brief, pages of your brief, going through the voluntary analysis of the totality of circumstances, and I didn't see the word voluntary or voluntariness even appear in the Court of Appeals.
Well, like I say, they didn't go through the same kind of exhaustive analysis that I did, but I would read their opinion to indicate that they were doing a voluntary analysis. They subsumed it in the question of consent. But it doesn't matter anyway, because you do it.
We have to do it de novo. But I'm just a little concerned. This is a published opinion, as I understand it, and I'm not sure if you're being congenial or you're being gracious, but probably both. To say they didn't do it as much as you did. Did they do it at all, and it's still there?
They certainly didn't do it specifically, but I think that a reasonable reading of their opinion would indicate, and since this was presented to them in the briefs, I mean, they knew about all of this stuff and about all of the factors and how the historical facts played into the factors, I think a reasonable reading of their opinion is that they did, in fact, consider it. They just didn't go through the...
There's no standard of review. There's no standard of review. It's clearly erroneous. That's what they end up. And I won't, again, ask where, because it would be a repetitive
my
question.
My answer, again, is you have to kind of read it in.
Counsel, since we are going to do this from the beginning anyway, determine whether there was voluntary consent given here, I want to move you away from the Court of Appeals decision And I'm wanting to be sure you and I at least are in agreement that determining whether there was exigent circumstances based on the facts presented at trial is a question of law, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
And your concession here today then is a concession of law, correct?
That is correct.
And it is for this court to determine what the law is, so we are under no obligation to accept your concession, correct?
You are free to reject it if you so choose.
Thank you. Do you want an opportunity to brief that issue?
No.
He has citations.
No, we made a calculated tactical decision as to what we were going to argue in the Court of Appeals and in this court. Our best position was an attenuation analysis, and that's what we're arguing.
You might lose on exigent circumstances.
Possibly.
Mr. Ballester.
And so on the basis of our prior decisions.
Mrs. Nels.
I have to ask this, because you lead off your brief with it. You told us that you think that taking this case, that we improvidently granted the petition. Now, I'm not going to ask you whether or not you were serious when you indicated that, but tell us why you think it was improvidently granted.
Well, because there were two issues that were presented in the petition for review. One of them was basically an error-correcting position, which was that both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals erred in upholding the search and seizure in this case. The other basis for granting review was a legal question. The petition contended that this court should determine whether or not to draw a bright line rule, always suppressing the fruits of the search that followed a knock and talk. That legal question was never argued in the brief. Now, I don't know why you took this petition. I was not privy to your conferences. I don't know why you took it. But from my position, knowing what I know just about the pleadings, it would strike me, and given your criteria for granting review, it would strike me that most probably you took review to answer that legal question of whether you should have a bright line rule on knock and talks, and that was never discussed. So, I mean, you're free to say, well, you're certainly free to say, and I'm certainly not in a position to tell you what to do, but, and you're free to decide this case, on the merits of whether or not an unlawful search was attenuated under well-established principles of law. But it just struck me that when someone raises two issues in a petition and then doesn't argue one of those two issues, that there's certainly reason to think that maybe the petition was improvidently granted.
I'm curious about the curtilage question. Are there exceptions to being able to invade somebody's curtilage without a warrant?
Oh, sure. I mean, most of the usual exceptions to the warrant requirement would apply.
Well, on the facts of this case, as I understand it, the total justification for the officer going behind the house in the backyard was simply to secure the back door. Is that an exception, or is that simply not an exception?
I'm not aware of any cases that would establish that you can invade the curtilage for the purpose of securing the back door of a house when you intend to knock on the front door to see if anybody would answer.
I gather the record doesn't tell you if you had to invade the curtilage to secure the back door. The record is not clear, right?
I'm sorry, on what?
The record is not clear whether you had to invade the curtilage in order to secure the back door.
No, the record isn't clear on that, but...
But the law is clear, isn't it? I mean, isn't the law the curtilage of a building no less than the building itself is protected by the Fourth Amendment so that it may not be entered in the absence of a warrant or some exception to the warrant requirement? State versus Walker, page 9 of your book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Any question about that? If you don't mind me testifying a little bit.
We do.
Mr. Balistrieri, Mr. Arpik was a probationer at all times relevant to these discussions?
He was on supervision. He had been convicted of a drug offense, and he was on extended supervision at this time.
All right. And I think the record indicates that his comments to law enforcement at the time of this was something along the lines of, I have nothing to hide.
Yeah, his position, which he made more clear at the trial in this case, was that he knew absolutely nothing about the cocaine, that the cocaine belonged to his live-in girlfriend, that he never knew anything about it. The first he knew about it was when the police came into his house and his girlfriend said, oh, my God, I got to get rid of the cocaine. And that was the first he knew of it. So it wasn't his cocaine. He had no knowledge of it.
If he hadn't provided consent for the law enforcement to enter his residence at the time of this search, would it have been following customary procedure that law enforcement would have contacted his supervising probation officer to do a home search?
There is no indication in this record that that's what they intended to do. The officers testified a number of times. Well, I don't think they even knew he was on probation. I don't think they knew he was in the house. They didn't know that this house belonged to Arctic.
Once they got upstairs and once he identified himself, does the record indicate how long it took them to find out?
No, that it doesn't. But it may have come after he actually consented to the search, because the consent to the search came fairly quickly after they went upstairs.
At one point, did law enforcement reholster their firearms?
The best evidence in the record is that Officer Wagner did this immediately when Arctic answered the door.
And then Mr. Arctic asked law enforcement to wait a few minutes before coming in. Is that true?
Well, he didn't ask them to wait. He deliberately delayed answering the door for a while.
And he accompanied that delay by indicating, give me a minute, which could
yeah,
be styled
right.
as a request or a statement, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
Did law enforcement honor that request?
Yes, they did.
Please continue.
Yeah.
Counsel, if I might, I just want to clarify something, because I'm having a little problem with Mr. Arctic's argument. Maybe Mr. Finley can address this when he has a chance to get back up. But on one hand, Mr. Arctic is saying, never heard them downstairs, didn't know they were there, no idea they were there, and just acts as if he never heard the law enforcement 10 knocks, what law enforcement in the back heard, right?
Yes.
But now today, it almost seems like counsel's arguing, boy, it's because of that barging in downstairs that he couldn't have consented because he had to be fearful. Upstairs. He must have heard that. I mean, which is it? I'm trying to figure it out. You know, from Mr. Arctic's perspective, he was arguing, I never heard a thing. And now today, all of a sudden, it's, boy, I can't consent because they barged into my house and I knew about this and I was scared to death. Which is it? You can't have a
I think the answer is it's neither. if you go beyond the suppression hearing testimony and look at the trial and look at some of the trial testimony, where Arctic did, in fact, testify on his own behalf. He indicated there that he was well aware that the police were coming in, because he had this camera. The camera was pointed at the porch. The camera was connected to a television set in his upstairs apartment.
But at the suppression hearing, that's not what he was arguing.
No, he was arguing something different.
So when we're talking about consent at that point,
he was at least arguing then, gosh, I didn't even know they were there until they were knocking on my door and waited for me to come answer, and then I let them in, right?
So,
and maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just an inquiring mind, but maybe he consented because he thought his girlfriend had enough time to stash or get rid of cocaine.
That's an inference that I draw without question in this case, because they all sat at the table waiting for the girlfriend to come into the kitchen.
If you have enough time to hide the drugs, then who cares
Artic knew, as he testified at the trial, Artic knew the girlfriend wasn't in the bedroom getting dressed, as he said. She was in the bathroom dumping the cocaine down the toilet. So when she came back into the kitchen, Artic had every reason to believe she'd finished dumping the cocaine, and there was no cocaine to find, so why not let the police search? They weren't going to find anything.
So you're free to search so long as we adequately got rid of the cocaine. But if we didn't, then...
Then you couldn't.
Okay.
Right.
Just want to be clear.
Yeah.
Findings, one of the problems with the Court of Appeals opinion, and I was just looking at it now, because so often it's convenient to look at the Court of Appeals opinion to see what they said the facts were, but if they didn't do the voluntary analysis, they don't have that part of the facts as to when he heard the stuff downstairs. Does the trial court make any findings of fact as to when and if he heard them downstairs? It's not
unfortunately, the trial court didn't really make a lot of specific findings of fact.
Well,
it was made this finding of credibility,
yeah,
which, you know, you can sort of gather that the court found this fact that the police officers testified to. But
they didn't even testify to when he heard them. So,
that's
just void. That's void in
there. Mr. Balistrieri, could you summarize your attenuation argument?
The attenuation argument is, and we, you know, we concede that there wasn't a real long period of time between the time that the officers broke down the outer door and the time they got consent to search. But there are a couple of things in the analysis. One is there is this intervening factor, and that's why I wanted to stress when I started my argument, is that this building was not in toto Artic's home. There's lots of evidence in the record, and I won't go through it now because I see my yellow lights on. But if you look at the suppression hearing, there is plenty of evidence at the suppression hearing that Artic maintained a separate apartment on the second floor of this residence. There were other people living on the first floor of the residence. So that when the police broke in, they didn't break in to the place they asked for consent to search. There was an intervening door, that is the door to Artic's apartment. The police got into that door by consent, and I will stress that there has never been any contention in this case that Mr. Artic's consent to enter his apartment as opposed to consent to search his apartment, there has never been any contention that Artic's consent to enter his apartment was involuntary in any way or was unlawful in any way. That is, his consent to enter his apartment has never been contested in this case. And that fact, the fact that he voluntarily agreed to allow the police to enter the very premises that the police asked to search, and that the police were properly on those premises, the premises that were searched, when they asked for consent to search those premises, is a very significant fact that takes this completely apart from what went on at the front door. At the front door, no question, There was yelling, there was screaming, there was a forcible entry, a lot of hostility, a lot of running around. The situation up on that second floor was very different.
Counselor, if this was really a two-flat building, Did the back door go into the lower unit, or did the back door go into the upper unit?
We don't have any information about the back door. We do have information about the front door.
And that's where the staircase was that led to the upstairs, correct?
Yeah. The police testified, and this is a typical Milwaukee duplex, there's one entry that goes into a little vestibule. In that vestibule, there's one door that leads into the downstairs apartment. There's a stairway that leads up into the upstairs apartment, and that's what existed in this case.
Okay. My question really goes to, was there any evidence that, in fact, the backyard where the officer was standing was the curtilage of the upstairs apartment? It was only the curtilage of the downstairs apartment, if that's the only place the door went.
We don't know that.
You don't have any idea.
We don't know that. There's no evidence about the back door, because the police never entered the back door, so there's...
You don't know?
I don't know.
Okay,
thank you. I have no idea. If there are no other questions, and since the chief has left the building...
not an editorial comment on your argument. She had another attitude.
What conduct, in the attenuation analysis, what conduct are we focusing on whether something was flagrant or not?
Well,
flagrant violation.
I think whether there was a flagrant violation, I think we have to, and this is different from the consent. This is different from some of the other things. Whether the conduct was flagrant, I think you have to look at all of the conduct, starting at the time they pounded on the front door, up to and including the time they asked for the consent to search. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Finley?
Thank you. I understand why the state wants to break this apartment, this home into multiple apartments. The record simply doesn't support it. The most the state could ever offer at this hearing was that the police officers couldn't tell if it was one or two units. There's no evidence that there was an exterior lock on the upstairs door. Officer Wagner testified he had no idea if that door was even locked. There was one kitchen servicing both the upstairs and downstairs. There had been a kitchen downstairs, but it had been completely removed. Mr. Artick's girlfriend, Winnie Grafton, who stayed with him upstairs a lot of the time, had a bedroom downstairs. That's where the police found her belongings, in a downstairs bedroom. There's just simply no indication here that this was this was two separate apartments. That poor term never even shows up in the...
Didn't Mr. Artick testify that he was in the process of changing it from a duplex to a one-unit residence?
There was actually, I believe there was testimony going both ways. So the officers testified at one time, and he testified another time. It was either going from duplex to single or single to duplex. But clearly it wasn't done. It was a single unit at that point, whatever was happening. How can you have two apartments in one building with one kitchen? It doesn't work. It simply cannot work.
So why do you think they just got done barging through the door downstairs? Why did they knock on the door upstairs? Why don't they just barge through that too?
The record doesn't tell us that. It does tell us that, and it tells us that the reason they didn't barge through there was because they didn't know if it was a separate unit or part of the same place. They were confused. The police were confused at that point, didn't know what was going on. That's the reason that they knocked at that point. In terms of, but we really can't sever these two incidents, the downstairs from the upstairs. That was the exterior door to the entire unit. And the record is absolutely clear that the noise was very loud. Officer Davila testified to that. Officer Lopez testified that it was so loud that he could be heard down the block. And this is really important. The question was asked, did the trial court make a finding? The trial court did make a finding, expressly saying, this is from page 110 of our appendix. He says, Mr. Artick denied under the circumstances hearing any knocking outside prior to the police entry. The court does not find that to be credible. The court makes an explicit finding. That's why we're arguing that he heard it, in addition to the fact that at trial he does say, yes, I heard them kicking the door, and it was apparent that he did in fact hear. You cannot separate the unlawful breaking down of that door and pounding on that door on the outside from the entry into Mr. Artick's room upstairs.
But for the trial court to have made that finding that his testimony was not credible, he
his assertion at the suppression hearing was that he never heard him downstairs or outside.
But that was the trial court's finding at the suppression hearing.
Right.
And that is not clearly erroneous. This court is bound by that finding, therefore. The fact is, regardless of what Mr. Artick says, the fact is, as we have to accept the fact, based on that trial court's finding, the fact is he did hear it. That is a binding factual finding, because it is not clearly erroneous.
Counsel, opposing counsel indicates that voluntary consent to enter is not contested. Is that an accurate statement of your position?
No, we absolutely contest the voluntariness of the consent.
Enter, as opposed to, he says his position was that you are not contesting the voluntary consent to enter. It was never contested, as opposed to...
Absolutely, we don't consent. We don't agree with that at all. Simply for the fact of the matter is Mr. Artick knew the police had pounded on the front door, hollered Milwaukee police, and when he didn't open the door, they broke down the door and entered with guns drawn. When they did the very same thing on the upstairs interior doorway, he had no choice but to open the door, knowing, as Judge Posner put it, in United States versus Collins, the jig was up. But the jig was up only because police had illegally barged through the front door. So, no, that wasn't voluntary consent. That was reality. That was the reality that he had no choice at that point.
Let me just clarify, though. Initially, right out of the box, you said, we're not challenging the fact that he did consent. What you are challenging is voluntariness.
That's right. That's right. The fact of consent, meaning he did say, come in, and he did say, okay, search. And that gets me to one of the last points I wanted to mention. Justice Segal, I think you were talking about the fact that he said, I have nothing to hide. That is not a significant indicator of voluntary consent. Just recently, in State versus Johnson, when the defendant was confronted with the police intent to search, he responded by saying, I don't have a problem with that. And this court held that that was not voluntary consent.
That was actually, Counsel, that was actually my point, but Justice Ziegler and I are often confused for each other, so perfectly understand.
I apologize for that. And then in Bumper versus North Carolina, when police confronted the defendant's grandmother at her home and said they intended to search, she said, go ahead. That doesn't make consent voluntary. That is nothing more than a reflection of acquiescence to an unlawful show of authority. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and thanks to both counsel for your arguments here today on this most interesting case. I want to remind those of you and the students that Justice Rogensack will be speaking with you shortly, and I think Justice Rogensack, you would ask them to stay, and you'll be out right
away. I'm just going to stay right now. So
and also, I would ask that Attorney Kate Finley and her guest approach the bench, and with all